Recorded live by jml.org.au.
So I'm very, very privileged to be able to introduce my father, Labour Wolf, tonight. It's been absolutely brilliant to be a part of this evening, and I think that all the organisers should be very, very proud of themselves for what has actually developed from a few people sitting around a table kicking an idea around just 5 or 6 weeks ago to actually having a star-studded lineup with fantastic information. So, let's begin. The Lubavitch Rebbe was well known for many different things, and everyone likes to take their turn. There are many, many books, many articles, many podcasts of everyone taking their turn to describe the Rebbe as a great humanist, a great intellectual, a great mind, such a special individual, a bridge between the old world and the new world. And the truth is, everyone is right, and none of them are exclusive. But I suppose this next talk is going to bring about a slightly different perspective to what people tend to know of the Rebbe. The Rebbe walked around in a black hat, black coat, sported a white beard for the later years and a grey beard before that, and spoke in Yiddish, Hebrew, and some English publicly, but usually preferred Yiddish in public. But what people don't know is that the Rebbe had many, many conversations, written, spoken, personal conversations with scientists, with doctors, legal professionals, and pretty much professionals from every field. And it wasn't just to pay tribute to their work, but sometimes to give guidance, instruction, encouragement. Viktor Frankl, it's attributed that he would not have continued with his research on logotherapy without that letter that he received of encouragement from the Rebbe. And so the Rebbe took not only an interest in the sciences and well-being, but the Rebbe wanted that through science, through contemporary teachings of wisdom, the ancient teachings of Torah would become apparent. It wasn't about merging two completely different worlds, but using one world to bring about a deeper understanding of another world. And one of those people that did receive a lot of encouragement, letters of guidance and ideas was my father. And so I'm very, very privileged to be able to call him up to share ideas of happiness that are built in today's most contemporary teachings, and how they are found not only in the ancient teachings of Judaism, but actually within the teachings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, my father. I always wanted to say this. Thank you, son. What a special occasion. People coming together exactly as the Rebbe would have desired, for the very purpose of not so much celebrating the Rebbe as much as recognizing what a such an important conduit the Rebbe was and continues to be in all facets of life. If Joel so ably pointed out the macro strategies that the Rebbe inculcated in the world, I'm going to share some of the micro strategies. Joel also mentioned in passing that there was a campus rabbi who went to the Rebbe in Yechidus asking how he was going to deal with 7,000 Jewish students at the campus at the University of Wisconsin. And that the Rebbe told that particular rabbi that what he should do is only tackle seven. Work with seven, as Joel said, and those seven will find their seven, and those seven will find their seven. That campus rabbi was myself. And as I look around, I think that I'm one of the very few who perhaps had the privilege of entering into the Rebbe's room and speaking one-on-one, asking questions and getting answers. And in so doing, my memory takes me back to the Rebbe, the person. What was it that I noted and noticed about the Rebbe in those Yechidusim that I had, 7 of them? The Rebbe was a man of balance, poise. Mind and emotion worked in synergy, masterfully. The words came out in such a way that the Rebbe was a Picasso of sound, in the sense that the sound created art of words, but often unexpected images through those words. Instructions that others would not have given or heard. What are some of those dynamics that the Rebbe was able to imbue within himself, so that both as a public persona as well as a private person, he was able to be absolutely appropriate in every setting, raising his voice with that right modicum of emotion just when it was apt for the heart of the other to be affected, and at other times maintaining silence in the face of query. To us who now see the Rebbe on videos, and especially when the Rebbe is questioned through the lines of dollars or other circumstances, how quick the Rebbe is to respond without even a pause, almost anticipating what it is that goes on in the heart and the mind of the other. Therefore, what I'd like to do this evening is to spend a little time looking at both the Chassidus and some of the contemporary psychology that Chassidus actually testifies as being accurate in that regard, that allows us to become balanced individuals in terms of mind and emotion. The famous dictum we're going to look at will be Moach Shalit Al Halev. But let me outline for you what I would like very much to cover this evening, which I'll only do by speaking either very, very quickly or not completing the agenda. I want to look at the higher self and the lower self, the Nefesh Elokis and the Nefesh Bahamis. I want to be able to understand with you the nature of ego-centeredness and the capacity to grow to become other-centered. I'd like to be able to look at the spiritual landscape in which our being finds itself. Quite apart from the geographical landscape of Australia, the spiritual landscape, which includes realms, olamos, energy forces, spheros, and ultimately how our individual neshama navigates that sea, that wondrous sea that is subliminal and we never recognize consciously. How is it that we're able to exercise free choice in a world that appears to be determined for us? Environmental processing, genetics, how are we able to escape all these constraints within self and outside of self? And then I'd like to look as to how are we able to reframe our reality, change the way that we perceive reality in a way which allows our neshama to be able to express truly and truly sing. And then I'll use an example of what is called the dojo, which some of the Eastern traditions means the hall where the martial arts actually takes place, and for us that's called the shul, as an example of it. So let's begin. The journey begins with me, with each individual, as a child, as a baby, we begin to recognize that the hands within the vision of the eyes is actually connected to us. And we begin to slowly exercise control over those hands. Months and months of observation leading to that simple notion, I can control my hands. And strangely, as life moves forward, we lose control of ourselves. Our hands, our eyes, our ears, and most significantly, our tongue. We have to regain some of that. The I has to become connected to the thou, to the other. We live in a world where media impregnates us with fear, and in a state of fear, the tendency is to be concerned about self. Tonight is about how to dismantle this particular attitudinal response, which is ingrained within our brainwaves, and move to the posture of chesed, concern with the other. So what is our spiritual ambiance? Where are you? We're in this absolutely magnificent Chabad house, but spiritually, we're quite elsewhere. In fact, what you see on screen are five parallel realms, or at least four plus one. It's not my intent to provide you with a travelogue, nevertheless to recognize that the terms conscious and subconscious really refer to the realm of Asiya, which is the pink one at the bottom, at which one level of your consciousness resides, called the Nefesh, and what in psychology is nicknamed as subconsciousness, a very general word, in Hasidic psycho-spiritual teachings, becomes the other realms. The realms of Yetzirah, Bria, Atzilus, and Ein Sof. You and I are there all the time, even now. We're only aware of one part of us, and that's the end of a spiritual umbilical cord we call the soul. That end becomes material, physical, shape, you, seated in your seat, me, standing in front of you. But this physical blob here is highly spiritualized. But in the material world, it appears material. When the ten energies, known as the Sefirot, which God emanates to continuously maintain and recreate the world every single second, because were he or she or it not to do so, it would return to a state of nothingness, as it was before the beginning. That recreation process flows into us as the neshama. You see it on screen as a rainbow arrangement of ten colors. When it reaches the bottom, it becomes you and I. But the point of the slide is to instruct us that we don't just live here, but we live in each of the increasingly spiritualized realms, higher and higher. And that's why you do have moments of much more profound insight at times. That is why we do dream. That is why there is such a thing as prophecy. And that is why a Rebbe can straddle those various realms while maintaining consciousness of what to you and I is the subconscious, and bring it back to us and instruct us of things that we cannot possibly know or ever learn about. To be able to increase our personal mastery and insight, the avodah, the work of mastery, this requires the balancing of mind and emotion. Firstly, as I already hinted earlier, we have to move from an ego-centered position to a compassionate vantage point. You will always be able to look after yourself. Don't worry. It's the preoccupation with self that becomes the real enemy. We'll talk about that. Another movement, a movement from a state of fear to a state of emunah and bitachon, which we loosely translate as faith and a sense of security, trust. The Rebbe explained it much more pragmatically than I just enunciated it. What is emunah? What is bitachon? Emunah, the Rebbe teaches us, is the belief that everything that has ever happened to you is for your current good. Bitachon, is the belief that the challenge you face right now will have a positive outcome. What's the difference between the two? Emunah deals from the past to the present. Whatever has happened to you is for your current good. Bitachon deals from the present to the future. The challenge you face now will have a positive outcome. I assure you that if we adopt the Rebbe's axiomatic proposition of emunah and bitachon, not only will our lives become much lighter and happier, but much more successful. Can I prove to you that this works? No. Can you disprove me? No. There's a 50-50 statistical probability that if we adopt the Rebbe's axiomatic proposition, you'll be much better off. And there's a 50-50 proposition that perhaps it won't. What do you have to lose? Live one day, I challenge you, in a state of emunah and bitachon, no matter what the challenge of the day, no matter what the memory. You know, God has a sense of humor. Creates human beings as the joker in the pack. Gives us bechira chofshis, free choice. Everything else works like clockwork. Predetermined. Except you and I. We are dynamic works of art, constantly changing our position within the work of art known as creation. How does this work? Well, as that soul elongated through those realms down to the bottom pink one that we had before called Asiya, down here it's as if it splits into two strands. One strand is called the Nefesh Bahamit, Nefesh Bahamis, our self-centered self, animalistic, literally, and the other is the Nefesh Elokis. What are their properties? You know them very well. The Nefesh Bahamis likes to eat, likes to drink, likes to acquire goods and possession, likes to have sensuous pleasures and the like. The Nefesh Bahamis is not bad. It just wants to maintain ourselves in its perception of ideal conditions. The problem with the Nefesh Bahamis is that it doesn't know when to stop. How much food? Well, I won't eat unless it's haute cuisine. Clothing? I will not wear anything unless it's designer label. House? Home? Shelter? I have got a chandelier in the lounge room, but also in the toilet. In other words, the Nefesh Bahamis seeks more and more, and that's why there are so many people who say, if only I have, and then get it, and still spend many, many months a year on the couch of a psychiatrist asking, why aren't I satisfied, or why am I still so insecure? Comes along the Nefesh Elokis and says, Ad kan. In other words, your wanting is desirable, but stop now and turn directions. Higher order self. Self-actualization. Personal growth. Becoming a better partner in life. Becoming a better parent. Becoming a better friend. being an agent for transformation within the world itself. These are the things that the Rebbe desired of us. So as that soul splits into two, as you see on screen, the two arrows, into ego and other, the particular arena where it plays out is our thought patterns, our speech, and our behaviours. I will either do, speak, or think for me, or I will do, speak, or think for you. I cannot do both at the very same time. Your consciousness, your state of mindfulness, is either self-directed or other-directed at any one point in time. The Rebbe insisted that if we practice Ahavas Yisrael, which is the epitome of other-directedness, you will still look after yourself, don't worry. The problem is, as I said before, in a fear-laden world, we forget about that, and we're into survival mode. You have free choice. Why? Because that's the greatest gift that Hashem gave us. Meaning in life, free choice. Unless Hashem gave us the capacity to murder, steal, hurt, on the one hand, or assist, help, confer, on the other hand, life would be meaningless. Who would we be if we were programmed to do the right thing without the capacity to do the wrong thing? We would be robots, automatons, amoeba, responding on cue. Total meaninglessness. It's the very fact of our fallibility, the very fact that we have the capacity to do the wrong thing, that the reward of meaning in life is enabled within us. Do this little exercise with me. I want you to look on the screen, and I want you to see that image. Become aware of feelings that arise as you focus intently on that image. I'd like you now to focus on this image, which is identical and yet not so. Have your feelings altered? And what about now? The image hasn't changed. The frame has. Reframing reality. Someone is yelling and screaming at you. What's your default response mechanism? Well, not you, because you're a very privileged audience. But a lot of people respond when they're yelled at like monkeys. They copy the other person. They also yell and scream. How useless is that? And inevitably that's the case. Why? Because they haven't done this. They haven't reframed. They haven't taken the same sounds of supposed anger directed against you, but reframed it by saying there is a reason why they're yelling and screaming, and it may have nothing to do with me. I had a lecturer in psychology who said many years ago in a lecture which stuck with me, everyone always acts reasonably, meaning there's always a reason for the way they act. To reframe means to say this. They're yelling and screaming at me. That means they're in pain. Emotional pain or physical pain. Otherwise they wouldn't be screaming. What can I do to assist them? Remember, you possess self-esteem. You say the Moedah Ani each morning. And you say, you restore to me my significance, my soul, my uniqueness, my capacity to make a contribution to the world. You possess self-worth and self-esteem. Therefore, if a person is yelling at you, keep your self-esteem. Help them. That's what I mean by reframing. And that's what the Rebbe sought from us. The compassionate repose to all those who we find within us. You don't like somebody? The Rebbe says, you never hate somebody. You never dislike somebody. Because you always love their nefesh elokis. You always love that beauty within them that brought them into being and makes their worth in the world their mark. Sure, you may not like what they've said, as good parenting always dictates. You never say to a child, the child, you are naughty. No, your action was naughty. Because the child is more than just the action. So the self-worth of the child can be preserved while the corrective mechanisms can take place. Let's get into something more profound. We're told by the physiologists, loosely speaking, we have a three-brain system. The reptilian brain, the limbic system, and the neocortex. And these carry out various functions within the body. I'm not going to go into detail. The reptilian brain is responsible for our instinctive survival functions. And the limbic system is responsible for our emotions, amongst other things. Neocortex for our higher mind functions. Now, the interesting thing is the next bit. The limbic system works three times as fast as the neocortex. Or, you feel three times as fast as you think. You feel three times as fast as you think. Which is why we're always saying sorry. Self-mastery in this regard means, how do we balance a fast-acting emotional response in such a way that it will become wise? Moach shalit al halev. Only the mind can provide the compass bearing for the highly energetic but compassless emotion. Emotions know no wisdom. They don't. Mind knows wisdom. But mind is cold and can't move. Emotions move you. Therefore, we have to take the assets of mind and emotion and be able to create propriety, like the Rebbe epitomized in every session that we ever saw him, whether I privately or all of us publicly. That poise, that balance, which was absolutely masterful and appropriate to the moment. That's where the three are, for those of you who just want to know where are those three brain systems. But it doesn't matter. The point is not to know the physiology, but to be able to work existentially with their results. And that's what we're going to do now. Look at the screen now. A vertical axis which divides AM from PM, or before and after. A horizontal axis that separates sexual mind from egos, emotions. Four quadrants. Quadrant number one. How do you respond to challenge? Usually feelings come first, for the reason I said. The thoughts that follow those feelings come second. Let's stay there before we move to quadrants three and four. When someone says something to you unexpected or challenging, generally speaking, you start to feel it here and here. You don't begin to feel it here. That's unfortunate. That's part of our training work. And usually the feelings are ones of fight or flight, as they say, or self-preservation. How can I maintain myself? That person is attacking me, whether in words or otherwise. And therefore the emotions tend to be negative, self-centered, even egotistic. So as those feelings come forward, mind tries to catch up. But unfortunately, it's taken captive by the emotions. The emotions capture the mind. What do we call that in English? Rationalization.
We give ourselves 101 reasons why we should have told that person off and did so really well. How dare you speak to me like that? My whole life I've spent trying to develop you as a wonderful child and you speak to me like that. What good, sir? That's called immaturity. The vast majority of people, unfortunately, always are in quadrants 1 and 2. They lead life of immaturity. They never allow their mind to truly rule their emotions, but their emotions rule their mind, and the result is hurt and pain, both in themselves and those around them. Quadrant 3 is where changes take place. Quadrant 3 is where you reframe, when you reinterpret, when you apply your mind. They're yelling at me, but that means they're in pain. You've reinterpreted. You're no longer angry at them. Quite the contrary, you're compassionate for them. That's called maturity. That happens after. That happens with mind taking the lead and providing the wisdom for the emotions. That's when mastery work available takes place, from quadrants 2 to 3. And when you do manage to get into quadrant 3, then automatically, you're in quadrant 4. Your feelings will change. They're positive. I did that rather quickly, but it's important to know that Hasidus provides methodology. Yes, I adopted it for visual purposes from the Harvard University conflict management model, but it obviously must have studied Hasidus in order to get there. And I've just put it back in its original container. Okay. I want to spend the last part of this presentation on the dojo mat. I want to take a practical example of where the balance of mind and emotion plays such an important role in the life of a Jew, and one where in today's life it's least practiced. Jewish people feel very strange in a synagogue. Jewish people feel very embarrassed in a synagogue. Jewish people are dislocated from their roots. How many people in this room or that you know of could walk into the rabbi's library or any major Jewish library and be able to point to the books on the shelf and say, yes, this is 2nd century Mishnaic literature, and this is 5th century Gemara literature, and this is 9th century North African literature, and this is 12th and 13th century Rishonim literature of Western Europe, and then the Haranim of Eastern Europe of the 16th century, right up to the Responsa literature to now? How many of us could navigate the library? You and I, the people of the book, no longer know how to read the book. Now that's not fault. There's been a Holocaust, there's asymmetry trends, that's fine. They are reasons, but that doesn't stop us from making up time. So shul is one particular arena. Why? Because I think in many respects the synagogue and the shul has lost its primary meaning as being that dojo mat. Let me explain. What is the purpose of davening? Prayer. If you look at the English translation, as we're often asked to, all too often what we're reading is seemingly requests. The Shemona Esrei is made up of requests. Please God help me with this, do this for me, do that for me. And it might appear, therefore, that davening is me approaching God and saying, God, please help me. And yet that is not the purpose. Because if you look at the structure of prayer, the requests come somewhere further down the track. What's happening in the beginning, in the psukim, the zimra, etc. and onwards. I'm not going to go into the detail. The purpose of tefillah is not for God. We're not extolling God's virtues. And it's not even for me to acquire goods and services. The purpose of davening is personal mastery, to develop as a human being and primarily as a Jew. We do make requests of God, but that's only in passing. Now, Because we don't do the first part of davening, or the preparation for davening, we've lost sight of what the whole exercise is. Stage one is learning and meditation. Yes, I say the word quite explicitly, meditation. Unless one sits with a sefer and studies some profound insight of human nature that might apply to you personally, and then dwell on an aspect of that in a specific meditative, contemplative repose. And the writings tend to talk about an hour, to do this for about an hour. But some believer ever says an hour day in time, an hour is not equal for everybody. So your hour and my hour might be only 5 minutes, and that might be enough for us. At any rate, that's stage one. Stage two. Let me show it to you right on screen. Study and meditation was first. What are we doing in that preparation period? The Nefesh Bahamis is like a wild stallion. A majestic, beautiful wild stallion, because there's innate beauty, but it's wild, of no service whatsoever. So the first step is to corral it. Move it away from our immediate arena. Let it not disturb us. So meditation and focus is that process of corralling the wild stallion. Stage two, the battle plans. Milchemes Pnimis. We are told that davening is described as a time of battle, which is really strange. Because surely the battle took place when I corralled the wild stallion. Surely it is when I removed the enemy from me. Not the actual davening. Surely the actual davening is simply me trying to get closer and closer to Hashem.
Yes.
And asking God a few things. Please give me this and please give me that. No. That's still war. Why is that still war? Because the purpose of davening is to tame the wild stallion. To take the emotional self and to be able to tame it in such a way that it acts in service of its master, which is the Nefesh Elokis. That's what we do in davening. Imagine if we came to shul and spent an hour in these three stages, intently, meaningfully. What a different experience shul would be. The important factor here is what I'm saying is the way that we're able to tame our wild emotions, because the Nefesh Bahamis uses the emotions in such a way that they serve us. We Hasidim don't practice killing off the stallion, self-torment, fasting, removing ourselves from the pleasure of Hashem's goodness. Chassidim act besimcha, ibdu et Hashem besimcha, serve Hashem with joy. What could be more joyful than taking our total self, including our Nefesh Bahamis, and let it serve us so we can actually rise in insight and wisdom and deal interpersonally much more appropriately? This is an arena where we can practice that. A little final story. When a medical doctor, who had not had a checkup for 25 years, was compelled to get a physical due to life insurance requirements, a large dark spot was found on his lung, diagnosed as inoperable cancer. The doctor died a couple of months later. Some days after the funeral, Dr. Chopra was sorting through the physician's effects and came across an unopened chest x-ray, 25 years old, revealing the same dark spot on the lung. The deceased doctor had lived a vigorous life all those years and was, in effect, killed by the diagnosis and not the disease. Living a life of stress. Living a life of fear creates illness. keeping our bodies healthy is a mitzvah. Why? Because the neshama can't express optimally through a body unless the body is in good shape. But the important thing is to keep the body in good shape doesn't just mean the physical body. It means our emotions and our psyche to be able to operate optimally, to act in unison, to act in comradeship, because that translates outside of ourselves. Emunah and bitachon are the ways where we can achieve that. If you have what Joel called before the vision, a vision of you acting with emunah and bitachon, and know, because I guarantee it to you, because the Rebbe guaranteed it to us, as the Torah guarantees us, that if we live a life at emunah bitachon, you will not be afraid, you will not be stressed, you'll be able to express yourself optimally, and you'll be of true service to the world. The Rebbe wants every one of us to optimize our giftedness to the world. Every person seated in this room, as I said before, is unique and special. No one is reincarnated, not for a real reason. You are here because you have something to offer. Every single person. And you can only offer it under those circumstances that you have the capacity to do so consciously. Through mastery, through avodah. In Yitz Hashem, I wish you a lot of hatzlacha, and may we all live up to the Rebbe's blessings to us. Thank you.
I suppose I'd like to thank my father for that.
Thank you for listening to another one of our great recordings. We hope you enjoyed listening to this lecture and found it enriching and inspiring. To download and listen to many of our other recordings, please sign up today for a free membership via our website, www.jml.org.au.